And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from a small cubicle in our South Street Seaport megapolis. Am I saying that right? Whatever this is, where we are thrilled to be joined 8 days into the NBA season by the great Chris Herring of 538 to discuss whatever the hell has been happening for the last 8 days. Chris Herring, how you doing?
I'm great, man. How are you?
Are you really great?
The season's been, I don't know. It sounds like we already might disagree on this. I think the season's been fun. It's been interesting. I've just been kind of ignoring my friends and family the last couple days, just trying to watch as much basketball as I can. It's been fun to watch. It's different to watch. And so maybe that's why I'm kind of mixing that up with fun, but I've enjoyed watching it.
I even got an email from my 70, what am I? I'm 41. So my 76-year-old father. And I'm saying the email in his voice. Oh, what's with all these 130 games? All these games in the 130s. What's happening? It's been kind of wild. Although it feels like it's slowed down a little bit the last couple of days. Last night's overtime. I guess not.
Last night we had a 126. Still getting into the 120s pretty easily.
I watched Utah Memphis the other night, so that's coloring my.
Yeah.
I believe it's only one. It's only one of like three games or some preposterous number where neither team reached 100 points.
Yeah.
It was like an old school.
What was that 93-84 or something weird?
I don't know. Something like that. Yeah. Okay, so we're just going to bounce around the trends and play sort of what's real, what's fake, what's maybe real, what's maybe fake. You know, I don't think any team has played more than four games, so it's a little silly, but you know, what else are we going to do?
That's all right.
Okay, Chris Herring, pick something that's interesting to you, and let's decide if it's real or fake.
I have a sense that you're going to have the same answer on this one that I do, but just scrolling around on Basketball Reference, the Lakers are the team with the best field goal percentage defense within 3 feet of the rim. The Jazz are the worst.
Wow.
Defense within 3 feet of the rim.
I did not see that.
I did not think that. And I just remember looking around just randomly, since we're going to kind of throw some crazy factoids around. And I remember seeing that. And I was like, that one doesn't strike me as something that will hold up for the rest of the season. But what do you think?
So that's either changed since you looked at it or cleaning the glass, which I'm looking at, has slightly different definitions of what is a rim shot and what is not a rim shot.
Okay.
But still, we have the Lakers at number two, 53.7% right. Field goal defense allowed. And Utah is at number, I don't know, 22 or 23.
Okay.
Obviously, what's interesting about the Lakers is that they're obviously getting lit up.
Everywhere else.
Everywhere else, including from three, where everything is a big, horrible red number. I mean, the lineups with JaVale have been good. The Lakers with LeBron and JaVale on the floor, I believe, despite being 0-3, are a plus something, plus like.
He's looked good on defense. JaVale, I mean, where he's, you know, he's doing his job at the rim. My big question about him going into the season, when you just look at his statistics over his career, he hasn't played 20 minutes a game since like 11-12, maybe 12-13, but I want to say 11-12. And so, you know, in those first few games, you'd see him come out. And he just looks winded, which you could expect that. He's kind of more of a specialist when he's playing with Golden State. And so now that he's being asked to play starters minutes, that was my big question is I remember when they signed him, I was thinking that's not their starter, right? Because he hasn't played the minutes of a starting player, but he's looked fine. You know, they obviously go small quite a bit, but, he's looked okay defending the rim. So the stat, while it surprised me, it makes some sense, but like you said, even watching that Spurs game they played the other night, they're just getting lit up. Aldridge just hitting shots left and right from mid-range. And so if you look at shots allowed within 10 feet but outside that restricted area, I think they're like worst in the league or second worst in the league at defending that. Obviously from three, they're really bad. And so that's the bigger question is like, even if they turn out to be a good team at protecting the rim, are they going to be so horrible from the other areas of the floor where it doesn't matter?
Yeah, what do you think? So I'm frustrated about the suspensions. Just because I want to see the Lakers. And now I have to see the fake Lakers for three or four games, you know, without Rondo, without Ingram. And Ingram, those are two of their five most important players. And maybe their second or third most important player in Ingram. So now I feel like I'm pressing pause on the Lakers.
Yeah.
And I'm frustrated by that. They lost to Portland. Close-ish game. Lost to San Antonio, wild game. Lost to Houston, obviously a very wild game. Do you have any – this? Everyone wants to talk about this team. Do you have any takeaways that are meaningful other than what we just talked about? Do you feel any differently about the Lakers than you did 9 days ago?
Not really. I mean, and I was emailing with you about this too. To me, it wasn't shocking that they started 0-3. It's not shocking that they haven't won yet. Now, if they lose to Phoenix, I feel like all of a sudden, I think the conversation will change a little bit more.
I love that one of my favorite subplots of the Western Conference is, and I was talking about this, I saw Nuggets Clippers, I think, on the first Wednesday of the season in LA, and the whole Nuggets front office almost was there, and we were talking about this. They knew they were coming to play. They were going home to play Phoenix, I believe, in their second game. The pressure that all these teams feel to go undefeated against the Suns and the Kings is like so real.
Because I thought about that with the Lakers because I remember looking at their schedule and I'm almost looking at the calendar saying like, I'm going to have to write a Lakers story really soon if they don't get a win by like this date. And then everybody kind of looks at their schedule and then you see that big Phoenix game and you're like, oh, they'll win that one. But I mean, they're such a new team that you can't guarantee that. One, and the other team I was thinking about in that same regard too was Washington up until they won the game.
Ooh, they
in Portland
needed that one.
Because they really needed that game because they're about to go on the same stretch where they're on a West Coast trip to start the season basically. And if they didn't get that game against Portland, you look at their schedule and you're like, when are they going to get one? And so it does become really interesting that, you know, what game is kind of a walkover and an easy one for you out West because there aren't going to be many at all. I mean, Oklahoma City
losing to the Kings.
They lost to the Kings, and it's a rough way to start your season when you don't know when you're going to get a win.
The pressure to beat those teams is real. On Washington, and this is not apropos of Washington necessarily. It's just something that has been in the ether. I think we're going to get a coach fired by December 1st. I think we're going to get at least one, maybe Christmas. I'll give it Christmas maybe if I'm in the holiday spirit. I just think something's in the water. Washington is like a team that I could see them doing it if it starts really badly. I think Scotty's done a fine job there. I don't think
They've
it's his fault.
They've already been weird though too. I mean, like even, I want to say before the season started, it was funny. We had Candace Buckner on our podcast at 538 last year and she said something I thought was smart and a lot of us think is that the Wizards think they're a lot better than they actually are. You hear it in the way that John Wall talks, even though John Wall is a really, really good player, great player. There's kind of the infighting a little bit sometimes, and at least the perceived infighting over the contracts and different things like that. They brought in kind of a combustible set of players this summer with Rivers and with Dwight. And I want to say Scott Brooks, he came in and he said, we just need to stop talking this year. And then, like, literally later that day, there was, like, a story about, you know, I don't know if it was Wall saying that they aren't respected enough or that people overlook them.
Austin Rivers said, you know, something about, I don't know why we're not talked about winning the East. Well, I do. Yeah. I know why you're not talking about winning the East.
And it just, like, there's this constant dissonance between roles. And I think John Wall already had a quote the other day saying, this is going to be the last time I address the question of why Otto Porter's not getting more threes, you know, and it's just like, what is the problem here? Even when they actually win and they play well or they look okay, I just kind of feel like something's off there and maybe it's just kind of the wrong cast of people, not so much players because there's talent there. There's no question that there's some talent there. Oubre has looked good. You watched the other night and Markieff Morris looked really good. He hit, what was it, 6 threes against the Blazers. And so they've got real talent there. They've shaken up the roster a little bit. And added to it a little bit, but it's, I don't know, whether it's them, I could see that. I mean, the Bulls all of a sudden too, talking about a team that needs a win and now losing Chris Dunn for, what is it, 4 to 6
weeks. Campaign, baby, get on the campaign train.
I mean,
do you want to see a lot of missed 12-foot floaters? Tune into your next Chicago Bulls game.
There's a lot of stuff that if you want to see and stuff that you'll never get to see anywhere else, you can tune into a Bulls game, including, I think John Schumann tweeted it that they, in that first game that they played against Philly, I think they had 14 possessions in a row where they scored and they were still only up by 3 points on Philly when they did that. And I was like, yeah, it's going to be a long defensive season.
That's pretty awesome. I like that.
Yeah, it was a great stat. But
they take a lot of long twos too.
Yeah, Parker is one of those guys. They got a few guys on that roster that like that shot.
I don't know how we got onto the Bulls. They stink.
But the way I got on the Bulls is thinking that, you know, I don't expect anything of this team, and it's weird because anytime I'm asked about them, I'm asked, you know, playoffs, is that a possibility? That was before season.
Understand.
I don't know where that came from.
I don't know. One of my bets with an NBA source this year, I don't make a lot of these bets, but we bet dinner on who has a better record, the Nets or the Bulls. And I took the Nets.
Yeah.
And I said this to people on The Jump last week, and it was universally, all of them were like, oh, you should have taken the Bulls. I'm like, I don't think so.
Why is that a thing?
The Bulls are terrible.
Why is that a thing? I mean,
So I'm riding Jared Allen and Caris LeVert to a free dinner.
I don't think you should even have to give a second thought to, I mean, I don't know. The Bulls, like, that's just a weird roster. I do get the one thing, I do get the impression the Bulls are going to try really hard to win, but, you know, I would go on local TV stations in Chicago and radio and, you know, do you think the Bulls have enough to make? I get that the East is opened up now without LeBron there and it's changing certain teams and kind of what their ambitions are this year, but the Bulls, to me, they had a really odd summer. I understand what they're doing. I didn't necessarily agree with it, but it was an odd summer. But my point in bringing them up is that Hoiberg, all of a sudden, like, you know, this is a team where there are at least names on that roster and not ones that I expect to get them a lot of wins, but there are names on it. All of a sudden, the season's gotten out to a weird start. Arguably two of the three best players are already out with injuries, with long-term injuries, and all of a sudden, you know, they're one of those teams, too, where you look like, where are they going to get a win? They've had some close games, but when do you actually get a W with that roster and with the situation they're facing?
Yeah, it's not pretty there. And losing is not pretty. And if they expected it to be pretty, it's not going to be. Let's go back to the Lakers. Everyone wants to talk about the Lakers.
Yep, me too.
So far, the two main worries about their team have both been substantiated. Number one, they can't shoot threes.
At all.
But this is what everyone was worried about. They are shooting 28.7% from three, which is second worst. The Thunder, 24%. It's not good. These stats after three games are just funny. Like we were talking about, the Spurs are allowing 61% shooting on corner threes. It's just funny. But the Lakers, they are, I believe, 25th in defense, allowing 117 points per 100 possessions, which would have ranked last season by a mile before the NBA went crazy. I've said this over and over again. I am much more worried about their defense than their shooting. I think their shooting will be average to a little bit below average. I mean, LeBron is shooting 15% from three. Ingram has not made one. KCP has made like two or some preposterous. So, like, I think their shooting will be okay. Their defense is even worse than I thought it would be. And if they don't make the playoffs, that's going to be – now, I'm not saying that. I picked them to make the playoffs. I called them a solid playoff team because of just my blind faith in LeBron. And other people warned me, including Ben Falk on Clean the Glass, like, LeBron's great. Like, his teams have been bad on defense for years now, and you just can't win a lot of games if you have a bottom six defense in the NBA. And that, to me, and the numbers, I just looked it up – Kuzma at center, 123 points per 100 possessions allowed, which is essentially like one of your players might as well be taking a nap on the foul line. and if those lineups just prove to be completely unplayable, like you can't outscore that. What the figure I just said, you cannot outscore that even if you have LeBron and four shooters on the floor. You just can't do it over a long haul. If they continue to just be completely unplayable, something has to give. Something has to give for them to keep up in the West.
I look at them and it's – I kind of look at a lot of different bad situations with that team because I look at Kuzma. What did he have the other night, 38, 37? I mean, right near a career high.
Yeah, looked great.
Which is
looked
crazy.
Great at the four, which everyone jumped on right away. You should play the four.
Right. And I guess that's my question is that when you run your small lineups out there, does he absolutely have to be part of them? And you know, his shooting ability, obviously he can score. So you look at him and the obvious question, you know, or the obvious answer to something like that is, yeah, you have to play him. But if you do that, can LeBron kind of be the guy that is playing center for you, even though Kuzma's out there and he's taller? That's part of it. Part of it is, you know, who else are you running out there in those smaller lineups? I said this, I wrote a piece kind of reflecting this a couple weeks ago. Hart is going to be massively important to that team. Like, I really don't see how.
He already is. He's averaging 17 a game or something.
Right. And I get that KCP is there. I get the agency connection there. I think Walton already kind of knows it. You know, he's been playing him bigger minutes than KCP, especially if KCP is not going to make some threes. Hart is a good enough 3-point shooter. I think Hart might have been the best 3-point shooter percentage wise last year on the team. Anyway,
and Beasley is not playing.
Yeah, but you can't. I mean, how do you play him if defense is your concern and where you're already really hemorrhaging points? Certain guys aren't going to help you with that, and I think Beasley is one of them. Scoring hasn't been your issue. They're in top 10 scoring. They're at the top of the league in pace. And so
Lance has been all right.
Lance has been okay. Lance, every time he dribbles into the paint, I feel like I hold my breath, even though I don't have any vested interest in how these games come out. He looks like he's constantly out of control, which has been kind of a career thing. But I don't know. They've got to find a way to defend. I didn't think they'd be this bad defensively. You know, they have, and it's funny too, what I was saying with their rim protection so far. They've got guys that are long, you know, they've got guys that can move their feet defensively, not everybody, but Lonzo is a good defender for his position. He's big for his position. LeBron, when he wants to, I think is still capable of defending.
Oh, there's no question about that.
So, you know, you look at that, you look at Ingram, and even if he's not a great defender right now, he has the tools to be that. And maybe it's more kind of projection with him, but, you know, at any given moment between that and having Hart, you've got three or four guys that can defend. And so maybe it'll improve just on the idea of how much more time they'll spend together playing. But that's why the suspension hurts. And really what I look at with the suspension, which by the way, I expected 4-3-2. I actually texted my best friend and I said,
everyone,
if I had to guess, I would say 4-3-2, even though that sounds light to me. They're going to have to suspend Ingram longer than everybody else. If they conclude that Rondo spit on Paul, they're going to have to suspend him longer than Paul.
Something came out of his mouth.
Whether it was intentional or not, I spit on the guy.
We're at a point in the world where I was nervous tweeting that video because I thought it might be fake. Like, I just assume everything is fake now. I just assume it's all doctored and I'm going to fall for it, and there's nothing worse than falling for something that is doctored. So I was afraid to tweet it out, but something came out of his mouth.
The only thing that made me feel, because I actually had that question too, and a lot of people, if you look at the comments under those tweets, they were like, this is fake. And obviously the Laker fans were, those people and the people that are hardcore Rondo fans, which I guess they still exist outside of just Lakers. But the only thing that made me feel a little bit more confident that he either did it intentionally or that he at least did it and it wasn't doctored, it looked like he kind of clenched his lip before whatever it was flew out of his mouth, which made it look like there was an effort or kind of a plan to do it. It wasn't much. And it, like, you know, the Phantom Cam or whatever that was, if the Rockets had their own camera folks there, it was pretty clear. I mean, because you had I won't say valid, but you had a lot of videos going around people thinking that it was actually Melo that might have done it from the side, because of just the shit.
I just can't believe that was real. Like, that immediately rendered all the Seinfeld jokes. Like, you couldn't even tell this. They were too obvious.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it was Melo over there. No, it was, I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
Daryl Morey, bad tweet by Daryl Morey. Pot kettle is a non-denial of what Rondo said about Chris Paul.
And people
bad
jumped
tweet.
On him right away.
Bad tweet, Daryl Morey.
Right away. But no, I thought that the suspensions didn't surprise me. But if you're the Lakers and you look at the West and what we were just talking about with how your eyes get bigger than your stomach when you see Phoenix on the schedule because of how tough the West is, having Ingram suspended four games and Rondo for three, one, you know, if Ingram is your second best scorer, you know, I think a lot of people would say that that's probably the case. And two, just from a cohesion standpoint, like, you got to have these guys on the court together at some point. The West last year, Portland was three games better than Denver, who didn't make the playoffs. Portland was a three seed. Denver was nine. One game can make a huge difference, let alone four, three, whatever it is. And so the Lakers, I don't know how comfortably they're going to make the playoffs. I still think they'll make it, but they're not doing themselves any favors here between that and just the fact that they haven't gotten a win yet.
People, let's talk about Hotel Tonight. Hotel Tonight makes it easy to book awesome hotels at amazing rates. They're basically a matchmaker between top-rated hotels that have unsold rooms that are otherwise just not going to be used and people who want to book those rooms. And even though the name is Hotel Tonight, it isn't just for last-minute booking. You can book for tonight, tomorrow. You can book your vacation. You can book beyond, whenever. Whether you're a planner or a procrastinator, I fall into the latter category, you can use Hotel Tonight to lock down your vacation plan. So to start finding sweet deals at cool hotels that you actually want to stay at, start using Hotel Tonight now. All right, enough Lakers. Chris Herring, pick another trend you're interested in, whether it's real or fake.
All right.
Let's giving you the go-ahead here.
Okay. So obviously Blake had 50 last night. I would say from where I sit, the Pistons are the most surprising undefeated team left.
Well, they have played the Bulls, the Nets, and the Sixers without Ben Simmons.
And I'm still surprised that they're 3-0, which I don't know what that says about them or about my prognostication. They also have won those games by a total of, what, 6 points? So something like that. I mean, the Bulls game came down to a last second play. The one last night against the Sixers obviously was kind of a last second play. And then, who was that first one that the Nets, you said the Nets game, I think was it like 127, 125 or something like that?
Yeah, it was a close.
So they've won by 6 points. So it's not, you know, I feel like they're not convincingly winning these games by any means, but Blake is averaging damn near 40. You know, I'll say this. Well, I'll ask you, what do you think of that and the sustainability of kind of what they're doing?
I'm not interested in the Pistons yet.
Okay.
I picked them to make the playoffs. They were my
pick. They'd be my eighth seed.
They were my pick for the one of the last two spots over Charlotte.
Okay.
Their wing play to me is the swing factor for their season, because Blake and Andre are, despite the fact that the meshing between them is always going to be a little awkward.
Yeah.
You know, they're good enough and talented enough, and Drummond is just such a beast of an athlete. Like, they're a problem every night for teams. And the wing play between, I think Bullock has been solid for them so far. It was actually funny to watch last night's game. Bullock is only shooting actually 28%.
Bullock is one of my favorite players in the league.
It was funny to see he and J.J. Redick were like mirror images of each other mm-hmm. every time down the floor. Stanley Johnson still can't make a shot.
He looks bad.
But I like that they're using him as a small ball four a lot. It's just who the other wing is going to be. Kennard is like a DNP in a lot of second halves and in whole games. And a lot of times it's been Ish Smith and Reggie Jackson playing together. And I can tell you this, that's the one issue that they are looking at, is how is Reggie going to take being off the ball? Because that's when it all sunk last year, when right. we had a couple of games where he just kind of threw a tantrum in the corner and put his hands on his knees. And you saw a little bit of that in their second game against Chicago. But he's made threes. He's made jump
him
shots.
Him and Ish both have, like, I mean, I want to say Jackson, he's on, what, he's hitting 40, 50% of his threes, if not more.
He's over 40.
And he's taken like seven a game or something like that.
On the ball, Chris Herring, 7.3 per game.
And so, I mean, so that, between that and, I mean, honestly, if I had to give a comparison to what this feels like from last year, it'll feel a little unfair because there's more star power on this team. This reminds me of what Orlando was doing last year to start the season, where people were like, when did Orlando get good all of a sudden? I remember Aaron Gordon was hitting 60% of his threes. Blake is like 60% or 61% on the nose. You know, and granted, Blake is a more established guy in the league, and so he could maybe sustain, you know, he's not going to get 50 every night, but he could, you know, have another 30, 35-point night without us blinking. But Reggie and Ish Smith and some of these guys are not going to continue to play to this level for, you know, weeks on end, if they even stay healthy, especially with Jackson.
Team-wide, they are only 37% from three, which is 13th. So it's not like they've been preposterous. I have enjoyed Drummond trying to shoot threes, including one that got all glass last night. Nothing for me has changed about the Pistons. I think they're a 40-ish win team, give or take three in either direction.
Right at the back end of that playoff.
Can I pick one now? Because
yeah,
I'm not
please.
Interested in the Pistons.
Yours are going to be better than mine. I've already used a couple of
How
ones.
Worried are you, Chris Herring, about the Boston Celtics offense, which ranks right now 29th in the NBA, ahead of only the Oklahoma City Thunder, who have only had Russell Westbrook for one of their three games, 99 points per 100 possessions. Are you worried?
No. I'm not worried about them.
Don't hedge.
Nuance is what we're good at, which makes us bad at answering questions like these. I'm not worried about them. I'm really not worried about their offense yet. I mean, they were bad in preseason too, which you don't want to take too much from preseason, but I think they're dead last and effective field goal percentage in the preseason. You know, Hayward shot very poorly. Basically, everybody shot poorly in preseason. I don't know if it was expected, but, you know, these guys haven't played together with this core other than last season and this preseason, really. And so a year apart, Hayward being out, Irving getting hurt. That was the question with this group, too, is kind of like, how do you make all these guys that are so individually talented, how do you make them fit together? Even though they're not selfish players, how do you make them fit together? Does it make more sense to bring one of these wing players off the bench? You know, how do you handle Rozier and other guys kind of stepping up the way they did and then kind of subjugating them back to the bench? I'm not that worried about this, mostly because they're there's not really anything pressuring them. I don't think their seeding will matter, assuming they're in the top three or the top four. I can't even really imagine falling in the top three.
I think they would like to get the one seed.
I think they'd like to, but I don't think it would kill them if they didn't. The reason that I'm not the biggest reason I'm not worried about them, their defense is still going to be solid. And now, as we're talking about how bad their offense is, I'm pretty sure their defense, if they didn't
win,
they passed Denver last night. And so that's the thing, is that even if they're struggling offensively, they're going to be in almost every game because of what they can do on defense. You know, they're going to have shot makers that can kind of keep them in a game. If everybody else is off, Kyrie might have it going. Kyrie's off, maybe Hayward gets it going one night. Tatum obviously can do that. So I'm not as worried about that. I think they'll be able to figure it out. I don't know. I just kind of trust them to figure it out. Whereas with the Sixers, I have more questions about them than I do with the Celtics. And all that said, I think the Raptors have come out looking great, and I think that they're probably more put together than I thought they'd be at this point in the year. What do you think about the Celtics? Worried?
First of all, the Raptors are absolutely loaded.
They look great.
And when they get DeLon right back to play some of the Norm Powell, CJ Miles, whoever is your least favorite Raptors bench guy minutes, boy, oh boy, they are absolutely loaded. Kawhi looks great. Their defense looks great. Danny Green looks great.
I thought it would take them longer than it has to just kind of put it together. Because Kawhi, I mean, and this is kind of what Kawhi has grown into the last 2-3 years where just kind of 2-3 minute spans where it's just him. He doesn't really heat check, but, you know, he's kind of testing out what all he can do offensively by himself. And, you know, the Raptors, at least, they obviously had some elements like that between Lowry and obviously with DeMar DeRozan, but they've gotten a lot better at moving the ball. And so it's been a little bit different to watch him just kind of go to work one-on-one. But I figured that would throw them out of a rhythm. You know, that's a big piece to add in an off season, and then just kind of have it work right away. But they look really, really, really good, and have easily looked like to me the best team in the East.
I don't know if Lowry has missed a shot the whole season.
That's the way it feels.
Doesn't seem like he has. You know, turning Serge into a center has been long overdue. That said, I'm interested to see how it impacts their rebounding. They're a bottom 10 defensive rebounding team now. That's always been the question of Serge at center, but I just don't think there's any other way now.
He's not going to give you enough at power forward. And I think really Valanciunas is probably more viable with bench units anyway. From a defensive standpoint, he may not kill you the same way defensively. He's had good stretches, decent stretches defensively.
Oh, he's way better than he was 2 years ago.
Way better.
But he's just – genetics are what they are.
Yeah.
His feet are pretty heavy and he doesn't jump very high.
Right.
He's not very fast.
You can make that work better with a bench unit than you can against
I love what he's doing. I get that players want to be comfortable in their role. Like, players crave routine. They want to know how many minutes I'm going to play. When's my first substitution? When am I going to go in and out of games? There's always been this sort of inefficiency of coach, it would be smart to change your starting five game to game. Why do we only do this in the playoffs? Why not do it in the regular season? And I think, you know, we've seen Ananobi start and come off the bench. We've seen Siakam start and come off the bench.
Right.
I think that's really smart. And I think it's put particularly Valanciunas in the best position to be successful. They're loaded. Back to Boston. I'm like mildly worried about Boston. Now, some of it is obviously Kyrie is now healthy and needs to get his rhythm back. I think he's 4 of 22 from three. Hayward is not there yet. And there's some feeling out going on. Like, I thought particularly down the stretch against Orlando the other night, which is an absolutely terrible loss at home, they were overpassing. They were passing out open looks. They were like, and that is a team of well-minded players, of well-intentioned players going overboard and sort of feeling out where and when and how and all that. But the problems are the same as they were last year. Boston was 18th in offense last year. You can chalk that up to Kyrie missing at whatever games and Hayward missing the whole season. But they couldn't get to the rim. They couldn't draw fouls. And they took too many mid-range shots. Those things are all happening now.
That's true.
I believe they're last in free throw rate in the whole league.
The shot selection's been pretty bad.
They are. I'll look it up right now. They are 27th in frequency of shots at the rim. They don't get offensive rebounds. So they're just they're their offense is orbiting the elbows and the three-point line. That's fine. Like, they haven't shot threes well. They're 31% from three. That will change. That will kick up. None of their guys have shot well, really, except Rozier,
I think. It's kind
of
like preseason, yeah.
That will kick up. But this is like, if you're going to win the title, and that's what they want to do this year, they want to give the Warriors a run for their money, you got to be top five on both ends of the floor. That's it. Like, you got to have an offense where the ceiling is top five. And that, maybe that will settle in. Like, last year when they had Kyrie and Horford both on the floor, they were a very good offensive team. Not an amazing offensive team, but very good. And in the games that matter, those are the lineups that are going to play 35 minutes a game. But these issues are now carrying over from last year. And if you can't get easy buckets, if you can't, it's weird to me that they don't get to the rim because they have guys who drive.
Guys who can do it.
And for all his dribble artistry and his creative layup finishing, I mean, Kyrie is the most creative finisher of layup. Like, can you even remember Kyrie dunking? Can you picture a Kyrie dunk in your head?
Mm-mm.
He is the most creative, ambidextrous, crazy English off the glass. He doesn't get to the line a lot, and he never has. I think it's like four attempts a game is his average. For a guy that can do that much damage, that's like not enough.
A little bit of a like Rose, Derrick Rose to him, where he's incredibly acrobatic and can do all this really fun stuff. I've read before that with Rose, I don't know if it was Friedel or someone else, that the reason Rose was like that is that he played so much ball, kind of street ball in Chicago, where you would kind of get criticized or made fun of if you called fouls. So you didn't get fouls. So he would always try to avoid contact like that. And so,
and there could be, for a guy who's little like Kyrie, not little, but by NBA standards little, and has had knee issues.
Injury
but it could
prone.
Be, could, yeah, it could be like, I'm going to preserve
but
my
yeah,
body.
No, he doesn't. And I mean, that's one of the most interesting things too about Hayward is that even with him coming back, I haven't heard many people I do think have kind of thought penciled in Boston as like the team most likely to make it out of the East. They almost did that last year without either of those two. And now you add in Hayward, who didn't even play last year at all, really. I don't feel like he fundamentally makes their offense a whole lot better at some of those things you were talking about as far as getting to the rim. And he specifically is like a one-on-one player. They have so much one-on-one talent on that team. We've seen Tatum make this enormous leap really quickly. Hayward, you know, if you remember what he was doing mostly with Utah, so much of it was based on, you know, coming around a handoff, coming around a screen. You watch those moments. You remember that series where they beat the Clippers, and Joe Johnson was the guy taking the shots down the stretch of that series in a lot of cases. Hayward's not – I don't see him as someone that's going to fundamentally transform that offense into all of a sudden catapult them into the top five if they wouldn't otherwise be there. I think he's a good offensive player. I think he can kind of fit into most offenses and do it without really disrupting stuff, which – you know, as good as Kyrie is, like, he's going to take a big chunk of your possessions. He's a much different sort of player that does probably disrupt it, even if it's for the better. I don't see Hayward as that kind of guy that just transforms your offense. And so it'll be interesting to watch. I mean, you probably are right to say, you know, it's cause for a little bit of concern with them. And maybe if they don't improve at some point, what their ceiling is.
I have more faith in Hayward than that, because I just think Boston's greatness is going to be in the collective and in having let's say Hayward is a second option on a great team, having him as a third option, having guys who are third and fourth options on a great team being fifth options on your team. That's
okay.
What's going to lift them up, because they're fascinating to me, because you look at the three other best teams in the East. Boston head up against all three of those teams. The other team is going to have the best player on the floor.
Yeah.
Whether it's Toronto, Milwaukee, or Philly, the other team is going to have the best guy on the floor.
Deeper than that. They had the Milwaukee series last year where Giannis was clearly.
Giannis and Middleton almost double-handedly beat the Celtics.
Right.
But the Celtics collective with all those guys
sure.
should be really, really strong. And that is still, despite the fact that they're 2-2, which sounds stupid to say, it's been four games, you know, I just think that starting five and the two guards they can bring off the bench especially is so deep in talent that I think there's a collective version of this team that is as good or better than anyone in the East, including Toronto. It's just going to be – it looks like it's going to take them longer to find it. The Celtics are a long play team to me. Like, Toronto is coming out of the gate more fully formed with a healthy superstar. Boston has more work to do, and – I think we're going to see, you know, can they build a top five-ish offense by the end of the season. I bet on them doing it, or maybe sixth or seventh or eighth or something like that. And maybe
you think they'll get that high?
I mean, if I don't know where they'll finish, but if they go into the playoffs and you don't look at like January 1 till April and they're in the top eight in offense, they to me will have been a disappointment.
Okay.
That's where I'm going to stand on them.
Okay.
Another stat, they're 27th in the league in drives per game. That's too low.
Wow.
And I think they define drives as like anytime you take it from 20 feet to within 8 feet or something like that.
No, I know.
That's 27th, and they're second.
I would think Kyrie alone would put you higher
than
that.
They're 27th. That's... According to this data that I'm looking at on the NBA's page, they're 27th. And they are second, interestingly, in the percentage of time that teams pass out of drives. They are the second most frequent passers. So they're not driving a lot, and when they do, they pass. Which is interesting. And you could just argue, well, those passes are probably leading to good shots, and Boston is not making open threes. Their open three mark is blah to bad. And so that will change. But I think it's just an interesting thing to monitor. Listeners, if you're intimidated by the stock market and cryptocurrency and all these things you just don't have time to learn about, look at Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, cryptos, all commission-free. They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just rich people, not just the people who devote their lives to being educated on this. It's a non-intimidating way for newcomers to invest for the first time and actually have confidence that they're not just going to flush their money down the toilet. It's simple and intuitive with a clear design, and data is presented in an easy-to-digest way. Other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, but Robinhood does not charge commission fees. You can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. You learn to invest, build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track favorite companies, personalize a news feed. You can have custom notifications for price movements so you never miss a second where you can really invest and make money. Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple or Ford or Sprint to help you start your portfolio. Sign up at lowpost.robinhood.com. That's low post, the name of this podcast, .robinhood.com. Pick something else, Chris Herring.
All right. So there's two. I guess I'll pick one. We'll get to the other ones later. And this speaks to something we were just talking about. Middleton, I think Nate Duncan tweeted it, that Middleton is now up to, 11 three-pointers per 100 possessions that he's taking, which kind of, obviously the larger theme there is just,
how many games have the Bucks played?
They've now played three, or have they played four? I think three they've got, and they're still undefeated.
The Milwaukee Bucks are 3-0. I'm going to guess Chris Middleton, off the top of my head, is 3-0, like 16 of 25 from three.
I mean, he's drilling them so far. He's looked great.
Let's see how it
But does. He's getting so many more. He's getting twice as many as he got last year per 100%.
I might be low. I might be low. Chris Middleton is... shooting 65% of three. 15 of 23.
That was a pretty good guess.
I think that's unsustainable. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that's unsustainable.
Of course it is, but what feels sustainable about what they're doing is the number of threes they're taking, which that was pretty – they were right up at the top of the league in preseason. And I think the Utah Jazz Twitter account for some reason put out there that the Jazz were kind of the most Morey ball team in the preseason. They were taking – 82% of their shots from either the restricted area or from three in the preseason, which, last year they were below average in the regular season as far as how many of those shots they took. And so, first of all, it seems like the shift in scheme offensively has taken hold. Everybody is taking threes. It's not just Middleton. It's not just Giannis, who, obviously for a long time wasn't taking threes at all, and now he's stepping into them. It's Lopez. It's Brogdon.
I got a stat for you. Ready?
Okay.
42% of the Bucks' shots so far has been threes.
Yeah.
Have been threes. Only two teams are ahead of them in terms of that proportion. Can you guess who they are?
Houston.
One. That should be obvious.
Yeah, that's the obvious one. I'm not going to get the other one.
Dallas.
Dallas.
Dallas Mavericks. You're fighting Dallas Mavericks on ESPN
Interesting.
Tonight.
I love these first week stats. Some people hate them and get angry with tweeting out this small sample size. I think it's fascinating. By the way, before I forget, because this was going to be one of my stats, but I tweeted it out, so it's already out there. The Warriors are basically at the very bottom of that list. They're like bottom, at least when I looked last, they're like bottom three when I looked as far as three-point rate. a three-point attempt rate.
I'll tell you right now.
It's been falling for the last few years. They were as high as number two a few
years ago. They played the Suns, which is like getting a vitamin boost. So they're now up to 22nd just by playing
just
the
Suns.
Just
for that one game. It's also, you know, 3-4 games in that the numbers are going to swing and shift. But, and Kerr has been complaining about the shots they've been getting where, I think Ben Cohen from the Journal last year, my old coworker wrote that, that they were the best mid-range team, you know, since shot percentages have been recorded last season. And so, you know, they have the best shooters in the world on that team. So why not, if teams are trying to take away the three from you and you can just, you know, pump fake them in the air and take a shot from 18 feet or 19 feet instead? It's not as efficient to take it, but when you're making 47% of those shots, it's still a good shot for you.
You know what I'm tired of hearing? I'll tell you what I'm tired of hearing. How the Warriors don't have enough good shooters. I keep seeing this, how the Warriors don't have enough good shooters. Like, I understand.
Kerr tried to sell that.
I understand the concept of that.
Yeah.
The concept is Andre Iguodala is not reliable until May when he suddenly becomes a superhero. Right. Livingston has never been a three-point shooter. They, you know, the McCollum situation went sideways and, you know, McKinney is a question mark. They have, again, bigs who aren't three-point shooters. Like, they have not been able to find another wing who shoots threes, essentially. So you put Draymond, one of those backup wings and a center on the floor, and it gets a little cramped. I get it. Like, boo-hoo. You have the two best shooters in the history of basketball, yep, and Kevin Durant,
yep,
on your team, often playing at the same time. And, like, you know, this idea, like, you have, functionally, you have four max players. Yeah, when you have that, which, like, no one has ever had before, building the rest of your team is pretty hard.
Yeah.
You gotta like take shots on guys who nobody else wants. You gotta get two-way guys like Quinn Cook that come on your team. You gotta be like, oh, David West, you want to chase rings? Come on in. Now you're retired. Zaza, right, set some screens, injure some people. Now you're gone. Like, this is what building a team is with, yep, four max players. You don't just get to pick and choose, you know, and they had Caspi. He can shoot. He's gone. They had, right, Nick Young. He can shoot. He's out of the league.
Yeah. I was wondering about that one.
Like,
because
this idea that the Warriors don't have enough good shooters, it's not even a first world problem. It's like a palatial problem. It's like, I just don't want to hear,
yeah,
any more about how the team that has Steph Curry and Klay Thompson does not have enough shooting on its team.
And that was partly their own doing and their own choice. I guess going into it, Kerr said something.
And I get it. I get what Steve is saying. He said they're top heavy,
which that's probably the best way to put it, is that
they're,
yes,
I shouldn't even make a joke. They're top heavy in a way that anyone who has ever built an NBA team
would love to be
yeah, top heavy.
Yeah.
Give me Steph, KD, Klay, and Draymond.
And I'll figure the rest of it out.
And then put all the minimum salaried players in the entire NBA, put their names in a hat. I'll pick them out. And if I don't get any shooters, I'll be like, you know what? We'll figure it out.
Right. They also took the last, what was it? The $5 million they had. And they decided to sign Boogie, who, guess what, for a big man can shoot. And so you're also choosing to go get a guy that won't be back until whenever he's back. And so they could have done something different with that. They could have gotten someone that would be there for the whole season who's known more as a shooter to replace Nick Young and some of these other guys that they lost. But, it's not something that even if you had a roster where only those guys were allowed to shoot threes, nobody else could. If you changed the rules for just the Warriors and said you can let KD and Steph and Klay shoot threes and nobody else gets to take any and everybody else has to play inside the arc, they'd still be a pretty good shot to win 55, 60 games that way. I mean, it would be interesting to kind of watch them do it. I mean, I kind of feel like that's where a lot of people are at in the league right now anyway. It's like they feel like it's so out of whack with how much talent they have that, like, the Warriors are playing by different rules, which they're not.
So, Klay, go ahead.
I'd be interested to see, like, if you change the rules for them just when they play and say that you have to play the game this way, I bet they could still win a lot of games that way. It's overreacting to say that somehow that their roster's hindered right now because they chose to make their roster this way.
Klay is also 3 of 22 from 3.
Right.
And you know the avalanche is coming.
Oh, it always
does.
Maybe 2 years ago when they first brought up
Durant. The 30-point quarter is coming from Klay. It's going to happen. So I'm going to pick another one.
Go ahead.
Chris Herring, do you believe in the undefeated powerhouse Denver Nuggets?
Yes.
Number one defense in the league with Boston, tied.
Yes. But here's why. Because, and I think maybe I have a thought in my head a lot of times when teams, you know, a team finishes the season and depending on how they go out, you think of them one way. And then depending on who they add, you kind of, you know, you take that into account and you say, oh, they're going to be better. They just barely missed the playoffs, so they'll be in this year. I didn't really like their offseason a whole lot. I don't know if you did. You know, they went out and they got Isaiah Thomas. They drafted Michael Porter Jr. And in my mind, what I'm sitting and thinking about and looking at, it's like, man, they're going out and getting more guys that even if they can play and even if they're healthy, which obviously they're not, these are guys that aren't going to help them defend one bit. And that's their problem, is that, you know, they're a bottom five, bottom six defensive team. Their scoring was never an issue, but they need more help around Jokic and, you know, they need to keep guys healthy. But the other thought that I had last year, I remember I sat down to write a long piece on Gary Harris last year. And I was trying to figure out, you know, and watching their film, like, why is this team so bad? Obviously, Jokic is not a great defensive center. But, like, why is this team so bad on defense when they have capable guys as individuals? Why aren't they better as a group? And now, you know, they've changed some stuff scheme-wise. And they have Jokic hedging a little bit more, a lot more defensively. But I think now I'm starting to see that, like, maybe if the scheme is better and if they're trying harder and maybe, you know, if they're thinking about themselves differently, that they realize, and, you know, if all these other teams are kind of slipping defensively because of the new rules or whatever it is, that the Nuggets, if they're defensively, if they're a top half of the league defensive team, they can make some noise. I mean, their offense is normally that good and that off the charts.
And I think that's appropriate. Top half of the league is appropriate because they are getting a little bit lucky. Right,
yeah,
now.
Absolutely.
They are only five teams have allowed more threes as a proportion of shot attempts, which is generally an indicator of bad defense.
Right.
They're allowing a ton of threes. And their opponents are shooting 30% and on open threes about, you know, below average. Like some regression is coming for them. And part of that is, as you said, they were like a fairly middling defense in terms of aggression last year. Like they started the season playing pretty aggressively, like you're talking about with Jokic coming out and almost trapping. They started and then they kind of eased back a little bit, but they were still, if you look at the numbers like percentage of blitzes and all that, like they were like a fairly average or above average. Now they're number one. They're the most aggressive team. And I just don't think that is going to work this well for very long.
Right.
I just teams are already passing their way into a lot of open threes and just missing them. Like the Nuggets have allowed the second most corner threes in the league, and teams are only shooting 32%. Like that's going to change, and I just think that defense, it's a lot of effort, and I think teams will figure it out a little bit as the season goes on. That said, I've always contended. I'm not one of these look at Jokic's adjusted plus minus and say he's a very good defender. I don't think that. I think he's been a below average to bad defender. But I've always said his IQ and his feet, he should at least be able to be in the right spot if he's in shape. And I think he can do that, you know, and he's a great rebounder. And Murray and Harris are young and getting better, and the team is just working its ass off. I mean, they are just trying hard. And, of course, they have Millsap, who's an all-defense-level player who plugs every hole. So I think this start is not indicative of who they are defensively. I think teams will figure it out. But if you told me they finished – I mean, I wrote before the season. I was high on Denver before the season. I predicted they would host a playoff series. I said, you know, if they can be an average defense, they're going to be good.
I was never that high on them. But I, you know, I keep thinking that, you know, if we know, well, we don't know this because Houston is, I don't know what to think of Houston, but, you know, the Warriors will have one of those top two spots. You figure Houston, even if they're worse than they were last year, which.
Can I give you a fun Houston stat?
Sure.
Just. Small sample size. It's just funny.
Go ahead. I'm curious to hear which one it is.
Rim protection. You know, you can track these stats now. Opponents are shooting 92% at the rim when Carmelo Anthony is the closest defender. Now, then you actually dig down, and it's like it's 12 of 13. So it's not that many shots, but it's just funny to say 92%. Like Zach LaVine, I think, is shooting 94% at the rim or something like that. Like, that's just fun to
Zach
say.
Zach LaVine's been incredible, by
that's
the way.
That's just fun to say.
I knew somehow the stat was going to involve Carmelo. I looked up one, too. I think it was him and Carter Williams.
It's not pretty.
I think it's like minus 35.5 net rating. But to be fair, that's, you know, I think Chris Paul and James Harden are like a minus 33, you know, net rating too. So it's not meaningful yet, obviously, but I don't know what to think of the Rockets. You know, the Warriors, you know, will be somewhere in that top four. I don't know who else is going to be in that top half, but I did hold out a spot for the Pelicans.
I was going to say there's one team we have to talk about that we haven't
hit. I thought that they would be really good this year, and I wrote about them in the offseason saying that, you know, and I know you did too, after the Boogie trade.
I essentially wrote, don't re-sign Cousins. Right. Unless it's a bargain. What I wrote was try to sign and trade him, which I have to go back and look at my notes from the chaos of what happened after their season. I just, because of the complexities of doing that and how many years the contract has to be and what his financial demands were, I'm not even sure that was feasible.
Yeah.
There was clearly some sort of communication breakdown between them and Cousins, but what happened happened.
No, I wrote a story. I know you wrote a longer piece too that I want to say I referenced in my piece. I think the headline on mine was something like, how the Pelicans lost a star but got better anyway or something like that. And that's essentially what's happened. I mean, it would have been a little bit of a tough call, you know, and if you told me the day after the Achilles injury that he had that the Pelicans weren't going to bring him back, I would have thought you were crazy just because at the time you're looking at a small market team that you don't even know at that point if they're going to make the playoffs. You know, a team that is capped out. So they're not going to be able to go get somebody else with that money. That they would be giving to Cousins, you know, a team that isn't going to be able to go out and get any other free agents to convince anyone to want to play there, anything like that. And someone that was playing well with and off of Davis. And so it's like, he checks all those boxes. You've got to bring him back, right? And then you watch, you know, they went on a 10-game win streak. They went into the first round of the playoffs and just dominated Portland in a way that, you know, I thought that series would go seven. I thought maybe they'd have a chance to win it. I didn't see them sweeping that series. And all of a sudden you look at them and you look at what makes that team so unique. And really, I think that they could hold their own against basically anybody. I think the Golden State series would be bad for them. And we saw why last year.
I don't know, man. The Warriors don't have a lot of shooting. I don't know if they're going to be able to score in that series.
They're going to struggle.
Yeah.
No, I think if I could address any one hole on a roster, you remember for years that the Clippers just never had a small forward. You know, they always had that top four that they had that played, like, what was it, 10,000 minutes together or whatever it was for all those years with Redick and Griffin and DJ and Paul. So the Pelicans basically have that, not quite, but they basically have a core that doesn't have a wing player that's capable of defending someone like Durant. And no team has, like, a Durant stopper. And in fairness to the Pelicans, they had Tony Allen. It didn't work out with him. He got hurt. But they really badly need somebody like that. They need somebody on that roster who can defend a wing who's, you know, between the height of 6'8 and 6'10 that can guard a wing player that's long like Durant. If they had that, they had someone that was like an above average player at that position, I actually feel like they would be a title contender.
Hilarious. That, wow. Chris Herring.
That's a huge if they had someone that good that could actually hold Kevin Durant, maybe not in check, but could hold his own with Durant. That's how good they are.
Hilariously, they just traded one of their sinkhole centers for one of the Clippers sinkhole small forwards in Wes Johnson. So they just made you just reference one positional hole.
Someone that never filled that hole for the Clippers.
The Wes Johnson commonality.
Right. But that's how much I like that team. Do they have holes outside of that? Yes, their depth isn't always wonderful. A lot of times it's not. You know, but Mirotić has worked better there than I ever expected that he'd be at that position. Davis has looked great. Obviously, Drew Holiday is still Drew Holiday. I really love that team, and I kind of feel like if they had addressed or if they could address that position, that's how good I think they are. And really, I remember ESPN at some point asked me to work out these hypothetical trades, which I hate doing those because I'm so bad. I don't think of trades well. I don't theorize trades very well. And so before I knew all the CBA rules and what was allowed, what I suggested is take Boogie, sign him, and then trade him for Kawhi and trust the fact that even though Boogie's had his moments and his episodes in this league, that maybe, you know, Pop, they'll be desperate to fill that role with another star. that, you know, has potential that hasn't been tapped in some way. And maybe the Spurs can take him, and then they don't feel as bad about losing Kawhi. Obviously, that, you know, that didn't happen. It wasn't legal with the CBA rules anyway. You'd have to wait a certain amount of time before you can make a deal like that. It would have been, I think Bobby Marks was telling me it was basically impossible. But if they could have put like a Kawhi there with that roster, for the majority of that roster to stay the same, obviously if you plug a top five player in there, but even if you took someone that's above average at small forward there, I would love that team. I would absolutely love that
team. Well, the most popular fake Boogie trade was, sign and trade was for Otto Porter, which is a lesser version of what you're
thinking. Think about how good they'd be if you had someone that you could plug there. All the shooting that you'd have a plus defender there. I mean, I don't know. Even without that, they look really good so far, and I think that they're kind of picking up where they left off last year, just dominating people.
Yeah, I mean, Davis is obviously incredible. Mirotić has fit well there. He's going to hit a shooting slump at some point. He's not going to shoot 9,000% all season. I'll say this. Solomon Hill looked good last night.
He did.
And look, he's not going to be the answer to the question that you just posed, but if they can get okay minutes out of him, that's helpful. You know, they'll get Darius Miller will do what he does, which is take one dribble and shoot and be on the floor.
The problem was that they couldn't play either of those guys long enough minutes in the playoffs to capably guard Durant. I mean, they played Holiday on Durant for long stretches. It's like Drew Holiday, God bless him, he's probably – I always have this rule that I don't like star players. Like, if I had to put together my team, I feel like it's too basic to say I would take Westbrook and I would take this person. I always, you know, and you do this with your all-stars, your Zach Lowe all-stars. You pick guys that aren't actual all-stars. I guess Holiday's been an all-star once, but I would say, like, he's my favorite player in the league that isn't, like, a perennial all-star.
According to my all-star conference multiplier, he's been an all-star 0.67 times. I think every Eastern Conference appearance since 2000 should count for two-thirds of a Western, two-thirds of, like,
so
a real all-star.
He made that
appearance.
One, and then they traded him. Traded him to the, I want to say, to the Pelicans from the Sixers. But, I mean, I remember the first time I still remember the first time I watched Holiday play in person. He was that good and that impressive, and I was like, I'm sold on this guy. He's incredible.
It's funny. He is shooting, like, 31%. He is 0 for everything from 3 so far this year, and he looks awesome.
He looks amazing.
And he was, in that Clippers game last night, I mean, he was in jersey. He was in Shea Gilgeous-Alexander's jersey, and he started the game guarding Tobias Harris for exactly the reason you're talking about, and he did fine. Like, one of the great – I'm knocking on everything in the room. One of the great pleasures of the last two seasons has been a healthy and, you know, past the situation with his wife, so the family situation is okay. He's emotionally – you know, everything's calm.
Yeah.
Drew Holiday, because he is a great, great player, and he played 81 games last year. He's healthy now. Even though he's not shooting it well, that's going to come. He just looks fantastic. I dig, like, the headband bandana he's got going on.
I thought he grew his braids out longer. I was like, I don't like that look. And then it was when they zoomed in on him. I was like, oh, that's just a bandana. People are – between him and Kyrie, the bandana thing this year. Interesting.
Yeah, it's just going to come down to what they get out of Peyton and Etuan Moore, who's just rock solid, and the Miller, Hill, you know, the three bigs are really good,
that
and Holiday's really good. Like, it's just going to come down to what they get out of the other guys. But I had them in the playoffs. They were one of my 8 playoff teams. I was not as high on them as you. And now I think, although it's only been 3 games, I think they're even better than I thought
I think
they were going
to
be.
I think they could be a 4 seed or higher. Well, I think they could maybe be a 3 seed.
Given what has happened to the Thunder.
Oh, boy.
And it's not that they're 0-3. We're not going to overreact to 0-3 when one of the games without Russ. Now, when Sacramento comes into your building and
that was
soundly, that's cause for concern. But they are just short on guys. I mean, they just don't have guys. You know, they've got 2 stars, one really good non-star in Steven Adams, and then a whole bunch of, like, uh-oh. A whole bunch of, like, is Patrick Patterson washed up?
It,
like,
reminds me of a lot of the old Thunder teams where they've got all this athleticism and no shooting. I mean, and obviously you've got guys that are going to have a night. I think you posed the question the other night. Who's their 4th most reliable player on
that
team?
I chose the word reliable carefully. Not their 4th best player.
No, just
Schroeder is probably their 4th best player. Do I trust Dennis Schroeder in a playoff game? Although he's had very good ones, including in that Washington series a couple seasons ago.
Right.
Him playing next to Russ. And a fun game to play all season, and it's only been 1 game. So do not jump to any conclusions. Do not assume I am jumping to any conclusions. A fun game to play is going to be when Schroeder and Westbrook are in the game, watch Westbrook when he doesn't have the ball. Because that's going to be a litmus test of is that going to be anything? Is that pairing going to be anything? Because if he does what he always does when he doesn't have the ball, which is nothing,
then the upper bound on what that team can build offensively is a little lower than you would hope.
There's a couple things that I kind of look at for what threshold they reach and how, what heights they reach. I mean, we had to fill out our our predictions for the season and kind of like who's going to win this award. I think I picked Davis for MVP, Giannis for Defensive Player of the Year, and
We picked the opposite.
I saw that, yeah, and then I think I might have been the only person that picked Schroeder for sixth man. If he were to do that and he were to mesh okay with Westbrook, because they're going to play those two together for sure. You're going to have to.
A lot of choice.
You're not making enough use of Schroeder if you don't do that, especially with the minutes that Russ is going to log once he's totally back and healthy. But man, like I just don't. I saw so many people answer your question that you posed about
Nick
the fourth
Collison,
most reliable
Nick
player.
Nick Collison got a lot of votes.
Did he? I saw a lot of people say Ray Felton, which I actually looked at. I laughed at first, and I was like, damn, they might be right. Like, that's a scary thought, that Ray Felton, you know, people joke about the guy. He actually has been pretty solid since he's been in Oklahoma City. And he probably is one of the more reliable players. But I look at – what annoys me about that team is that they're just so athletic where, like, the team – you know, you remember Miami back in the day. We've talked about them so many times about the way that they could just change a game with blitzing or playing up. Sometimes they run Noel out there, and you know Diallo is so athletic.
I like him. I'm interested to watch him. He's already made a good first impression.
I really like him a lot. But I mean, that's just their bench unit, and obviously you kind of have moments where you're going to play George out there. They really need to have Robertson back, and I mean, I think that's kind of the key. You don't know what he's going to look like when he comes back because he's coming off a major, major injury. But I mean, he presented a night and day difference for that team last year when he was on the court. Even I think when you just took the other four starters with him and then without him, that they basically went from first to worst defensively in terms of their net rating and what they were doing on defense because he's that good. And I think having him and George in there on defense together just kind of is a game changer with two wings that long.
Yeah.
And when you don't have him or when you do have him and he's not healthy, I don't know. I actually kind of looked at that report when it came out. They said that he had the setback. And I was like, I think that's more important than losing Russ for a few games. Losing Robertson for potentially another month, 2 months, that's a bigger deal to me than losing Russ for 5 games or so.
It's interesting that they just don't trust Abrinas because that's the one I would like.
He can shoot.
I would like to see a version of the Thunder where Billy Donovan was just like, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm just going to do it for 15 straight games. He's going to play 25 minutes a game. And you even see like he'll play in the first half and then he won't play in the second half. They just don't trust. I understand defensively he's a minus, but I just would like to see what it would look like if they just held their nose and was like, you know what? He's going in. He's in the rotation. That's it.
You kind of have to do that with guys. If you have a guy that can shoot 40% from the floor.
From three. Yeah.
I'm sorry, from three. I've been surprised by a couple of – Korver hasn't really been getting minutes in
they
Cleveland.
They got to trade him. Let's get him somewhere where he can play.
Yeah, because that so just looks odd that something. He's not there, especially as bad as everybody else is on defense. But it's really – I always kind of wonder that too. Like what do you have to lose if you have no shooting and you've got a guy on your bench that can shoot that well? I covered Steve Novak with the Knicks. It's a different question in the playoffs, obviously. Playoffs, every possession matters so much. You know, if you go down by a game – that matters so much. But like in the regular season, you can afford to give guys a little bit more run than that in hopes that they'll, you know, if you're forcing a defense to be honest or, you know, to keep them honest and Russ has a little bit more room to penetrate or Schroeder, whoever it is, it's a game changer if you've got somebody out there who can hit those kinds of shots.
Even more so than Robertson, if I had to gift one player in the NBA one skill that they just don't have, it would be to gift Jeremy Grant three-point shooting. If that guy could just hit open corner threes, boy, is he a good
NBA
player.
He has moments where he looks so good, and normally when those moments come up, it's when he's hitting shots because he can do everything else.
We hear all the time, this guy can guard all five positions, and really they can't. They can guard like the middle three. They can't guard one or five.
Yeah.
He can legit guard all five positions.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying with that bench unit, though, is just him, and you've got Diallo, and you've just got so much athleticism with them and Noel and that second group, and you just have no shooting. And you know what? As we're talking about stats and surprising stats, the favorite one of mine that I had that I tried so hard to build a story around, and they just were giving me these really blank sort of responses, these blah responses. But I think it was 3 years ago that the two Grants, Jeremy and Jaren, had the two worst 3-point shooting percentages in the league among guys that took 100 or more that season. And I was like, that's a cool stat. Probably not for them.
Not for their family.
Not for them. But I wanted to build this story around kind of like, what's it like? And I think it falls flat when you realize that Clay's dad was a big man. But I think it's so fascinating when you have a parent that is a big man and then you become a guard, at least with Jaren, maybe not so much with Jeremy. You know, what is the process like of learning how to shoot if your dad didn't really have to know how to or wasn't like a perimeter shooter where he had to learn how to shoot to that extent? And so that was the idea I was going to take into that story. I ended up doing something really short on it, but I thought that was so interesting. And then Jeremy had a really nice leap the next year. And so that's the question is whether as all these other guys learn how to shoot threes and some of them seemingly shoot overnight, you know, they go from not shooting at all to being a 35% shooter, which that's what blows me away is the big men that can do that. But, you know, at what point does it kind of click for Jeremy? Because if he does that, he's going to be in the league for a long, long, long time. Just kind of a guy that can do a little bit of everything if he can shoot.
Favors is the interesting one like that to me this year because he was 14 of 63 last year from three. That's 22% after having taken like 15 for his entire career. And we sat down mid-season and I asked him about that and he said, yeah, it's going to be next year. I can already tell it's going to be next year. This is the year where I get my feet wet. Doesn't feel great for me.
You just have to take him.
But in three games, he's 0 for 3.
So I'm slowing down on it a little bit.
Because if he can shoot threes, that changes how their starting lineup looks. Not even shoot threes. If he can just be out of the way and make corner threes, that changes how that starting lineup, which should function okay regardless. It just gives it different forms that it can take. And if he can't, that builds in a downside where they might go through 5, 6, 7 games where that lineup doesn't work as well as you would hope. And if that happens in the playoffs, then you got to adjust really fast. So he's the interesting litmus test to me.
Yeah.
Listeners, you know, I love things that can save me time and few things seem as time consuming from the outside as searching for a job candidate. There are job sites that make you wait for the right candidates to apply for your job. There are a million different job sites out there. Where do you post it? How do I know I'm meeting the right people? All of that. But you know what makes all those problems go away? Going to ZipRecruiter.com and especially ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost to hire the right person. ZipRecruiter does not depend on candidates finding you. It finds you for them. It uses its powerful matching technology to scan through thousands of resumes, identify people with the right skills, education, experience, all of that, and actively invites those people to apply to your job so that you get everything. It sifts through everything. You get the best stuff. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. That rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at that exclusive web address I gave you before, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, the name of this podcast. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. The one team we didn't get a chance to talk about because we have to go. Just people, give the Charlotte Hornets a watch. James Borrego is like, he might play you at center tonight. That's fine. MKG at center. Marvin Williams at center.
They've been rolling some interesting lineups out there.
Letting it fly. Give the Charlotte Hornets a watch. I don't know if it's going to work, but they're 2-2, and they almost beat the Bucks on opening, the real opening night.
They've had these deficits, too, that they come back from. That opening night, they were down by so many points, and Kemba's been so much fun. I mean, Kemba, you think about certain people and just, you know, you watch them and they kind of look like they're out there by themselves, but they've been fun to watch this year. And I was telling you in the email, Bridges, I feel like at some point they're going to have to just kind of unleash that guy as far as
I know Borrego was surprised. Saw them in Boston in preseason and he told me in the hallway, I was like, that dude's good.
He is really good.
We didn't really realize he could shift to four like that.
Yeah.
And do all the things he can do.
Yeah. I have a soft spot for Charlotte, partly because, you know, I think I always have a soft spot for smaller markets and teams that can't quite get over that hump and have what looks like the talent to get it done. I have a soft spot for guys that can't shoot. So MKG is kind of one of my favorite players in the league to watch.
Yeah, you know what?
He hit a three the other
night. My Jeremy Grant gift, maybe I should bestow it upon MKG instead.
He works so hard. He hit a three the other night, and I remember thinking, man, I can't remember the last time I saw it. Then I looked, and it had been almost calendar years.
He's made 7 in his career, so you saw one of the 7.
Yeah.
It was against the Raptors. It was a corner three against the Raptors.
It had been almost 2 calendar years since he'd made one, and so the fact – I do like that element of the game this year, that guys are just shooting them. I think that it's really going to kind of leave certain guys extinct in the next year or two. Like, if you can't shoot them and everyone's willing to at least take them.
I'm going to write this in a 10 things column this week. We're all analytics friendly. I'm analytics adjacent. I get it. I've always been pro analytics. Last year, I came to grips with the fact that we're going to see a lot of guards pass out of contested layups to shoot threes. It's like, all right, this, I kind of like contested layups. So the rim's right there. You should try and put the ball into the rim. This year, I've seen big men, like, I'm going to highlight this play on Friday. Knicks Nets from whatever day that was in Brooklyn. Nets were up by 3, I think, with like 40 seconds left. Jared Allen catches the ball on a pick and roll at the rim almost. And like, I don't have it in front of me. It's like a guard comes to help. So he's 5 feet from the rim with a guard in front of him. He can just go up and he shot like 75% from the line last year. So he can't hide behind like, I don't want to get fouled. He passed it out.
Yeah.
For that. Like, dude, you're 7 feet tall. That other guy is 6 foot five. Yeah. Dunk the ball. Alex Len has done it a couple times. Like, what purpose are you in the NBA? If you're 7 feet tall, you're going to pass out for three.
Yeah.
Stop doing that. And I sound like my father, but
we're
just
hit that
dunk. The
yeah.
ball. You're a large human, and the guy in front of you is a smaller human.
Yeah.
Dunk the ball. Anyway, Chris Herring, your work for 538 is always tremendous. You cover the whole league. You watch a million games. It's a pleasure to have you on and talk early season nonsense trends. Look for Chris's work, of course, at 538. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.